Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu. I'm without my regular co-host, Justin Lee Burke, but I have my wonderful producer, Dr. Clara Mao. Say hi.
Hey.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Rebecca McDonald Yilmaz to discuss hospice and end-of-life care. But first, Clara, do you want to remind us what the show is about?
Yeah, so we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the field to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine. We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. McDonald Yilmaz, who is board-certified in pediatrics, hospice and palliative medicine, and pediatric oncology. She provides palliative care at Hasbro Children's Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, and runs a pediatric home hospice program. Today, she teaches us about the unique aspects of pediatric concurrent hospice care and other myths, how to prepare families for the end of life, and how to discuss death and dying with children.
Clara, it sounds like your cat was really excited to listen to this episode as well.
Yeah, he's trying to run away right now, but...
All right, let's get to it. Oh. See, that worked out well.
Yeah.
What's your cat's name?
His name is Finn. He's been banging at the door. He likes to paw and try to hit the doorknob. It's been the whole episode.
I had a cat. She's no longer with us anymore, but she actually, not only would she hit the doorknob, she would open the doors with the doorknob. She was always so
That's
good.
That's really impressive.
Like she could, even the round doorknob.
Even the round
she would
ones?
Able, yeah. She was the type of cat that she would get on two legs and pull drawers out to allow her to step up onto things. She was a horrible cat because she got into everything. She was just too smart. So
yeah,
our lives got better after she died. So I love that cat. She was my cat.
Gosh.
So. All right. I have Dr. Becky McDonald Yilmaz. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, because we're sort of an informal group, would it be okay if I call you by your first name during our discussion?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, most of my patients and their families call me Dr. Becky because it's just easier. And I'm a pediatrician.
I was going to say, how very pediatrician.
Yes.
So we'll start off with some warm-up questions. To help our listening audience to sort of get to know you better, can you give us a little description about yourself and maybe something outside of medicine that you enjoy?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my work life, I am a pediatric palliative care attending and I run a pediatric home hospice team. But outside of that, I'm a mom of three kids and a rambunctious Jack Russell Terrier puppy. Although he's not a puppy, but he still acts like it. So it's like a fourth kid. I'm a wife and I really enjoy writing and reading and just hanging out with my family.
Fantastic. Clara, do you have any questions?
Yeah, it sounds like you love to read. So what is your, a book that you would recommend to any physician or just your favorite book that you've read recently?
Okay. Well, I have to recommend something in palliative care. And there are two books that I think that so much of medicine would benefit from more people reading. One is actually pretty old. It's called Dying Well, and it's by Dr. Ira Byock, who is one of the giants in the field of palliative care. He's actually the person who first introduced me to it when I was lucky enough to work with him briefly on an internship while I was in graduate school for public health. It's a collection of stories and vignettes really showing how palliative care can impact people's lives, especially at the end. And then more recently, there was a really excellent one published called With the End in Mind. It's by Catherine Mannix, who is also a palliative care physician. And again, a really thoughtful collection of stories. When I was reading that one, now that I'm an attending physician, I just felt so seen by her experiences. So I think they're really good accounts to really shed light on the specialty and what it involves.
Very cool. I'll definitely have to check those out. We get so many book recommendations, though. We're going to have to try to figure this out because there's no way I'm getting through everything, but those sound fantastic. So excellent. I guess going from maybe something a little quicker, are there any TV shows or anything that you'd recommend that we watch, something shorter?
I honestly don't watch a ton of TV because I don't have a ton of time.
Perfect. Any fun thing that your kids are into recently?
Oh gosh, my boys are super into sports. So we've got a baseball camp going on this week and a soccer camp, and my daughter's into gymnastics and swimming. So I'm entering that phase of shuttling to various activities that I've heard so much about from people with kids who are older than mine.
And all this right before school starts, huh?
Yes, absolutely. Wow. We are gearing up for that. So I'm sort of managing my roles at work and my job as a shuttle service and keeping track of who has to be where, when, and what, you know, consents have been signed and what kind of, you know, information about who's picking who up.
Oh, I know the feeling. My wife just took my 10-year-old. His second parkour class is today. So we figure he's going to be jumping off roofs and stuff anyways. We might as well make sure he's taught how to do it correctly, I guess.
Absolutely. I bet that's going to be a highlight for him.
Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, and therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Free do the rest. Start your free trial today. No credit card needed. Use code CURB50, that's CURB50, to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe.
All right, Clara, what do you think? Should we start getting into our case?
Yeah, let's do it. So we have a case here from Cashlock Children's. So you are getting a consult to see Eva, who is a 10-year-old. She has end-stage heart failure. She requires a continuous inotrope drip to keep her heart functioning. And over the past few months, she's had kind of ongoing decline with more frequent hospitalizations for symptoms that her family just can't manage at home, and more complications from her heart failure. Her family is aware of the situation, you know, because this has been an issue for most of her life, and they don't want her to suffer, but they also don't want to just stop everything. So how do you even start the conversation about hospice with patients and their families when we get to this point in their care?
Yeah, that is a good question. So probably throughout our conversation, I'm going to make the case for early involvement of palliative care and hospice, because really the first way to even be able to approach this in a way that's going to be collaborative and supportive is for me to get to know the patient and their family. I think especially when you're going to start talking about really big and scary things, like even palliative care itself can scare people, or hospice, you need to have some sort of rapport, some sort of reason that people might listen to what you're saying and believe that you truly have, you know, their best interests in mind. So with a patient like this, that would be my first step, getting to know them, getting to know their family. But also, the thing that sticks out to me in a case like this, especially with kids who have like cardiac or respiratory conditions, is what is their level of function? And I think that's a really important thing to determine what they're able to do and what's important to them, right? So my job is never, ever to direct a patient or a family to do a specific thing, to talk them in or out of any intervention or process. My job is to get to know them, what's important to them, align that with my medical knowledge of where I think things might be going in the future, and then help them to select options for care that are most true to their values and what they want. So for a child like this, you know, it stands out to me that she's been spending more and more time in the hospital, because almost no family has that, you know, at the forefront of their goals. No one is like, we would really like to spend more time in this hospital. That would be absolutely the best for everybody. So, you know, it makes me think, I'm glad you brought up, how would you talk about hospice? Because I think that's absolutely a path that I would really seriously explore with this patient and their family. But I would couch it in a way of sort of summarizing, okay, here's our situation, right? We know that her heart is not working well, and we know that unfortunately, she needs this medicine all the time to keep it working. We also know that that's keeping her in the hospital for a lot of time. And so then I would say something like, you know, I think it would be helpful, or I wonder if we could talk about bringing another service in to try to help her stay feeling as good as possible, but at home. And usually people are going to say yes. And then I'll say to them, I'm about to say a really scary word right now. It's sort of my warning shot in the same way we teach people to do before they're delivering bad news. I say that word is hospice, and that's a really scary word to hear ever, and especially when we're talking about your child. And then I really pause to see what their reaction is going to be, because that is very much going to guide how we talk further. Are they aware that it might be time to think about this and are just sad or want to know more? Or have they never heard of hospice before? Or are they like, oh my God, that's the death squad. Like, we don't want that. You got to find out where people are coming from before you can really keep going with the conversation.
Now, one question, I've done this conversation a couple of times as well. Yeah. One question I often get is sort of the difference between what's hospice and what's palliative care, because us as clinicians, we often use them interchangeably, but it confuses patients. How would you answer that question for a patient?
Yeah. So I always tell people that hospice is care for people who we know are approaching the end of their life. So they're for people who we really think that their body is starting to shut down, and we know that unfortunately the end is likely coming. And hospice care is a way to care for folks that really focuses on not just doing anything at any cost to keep them alive for longer, but helping them to feel as good as possible for as long as possible. And that involves, I can go into separately sort of what does hospice care look like? Okay. Palliative care is a much, much broader area. So it certainly encompasses hospice. And many times, you know, there's a reason our fellowships for physicians are hospice and palliative medicine. So many times they overlap, or maybe in the course of getting palliative care, you have discussions and ultimately decide to switch on to hospice. But palliative care is care for any person with a life-limiting illness. It does not have to be terminal. They do not have to be right at the end of life. I've had many palliative care patients who get better or get over whatever illness had them in the hospital. And frankly, that's amazing. And I love to cheer for them and celebrate with them when there are good outcomes. So palliative means somebody is seriously ill and has a lot going on, but it doesn't mean their end of life. Hospice is really the very end of life, and really a lot of times putting a big focus on, I don't like the term quality of life because I think it implies judgment, and what I think is quality might not be what somebody else thinks is quality, but on helping and support them to feel the best they can.
So you were talking about early intervention before. Would it be possible that a patient would start off with an early intervention into more of a palliative world, and then as the disease may progress, then they become more what we consider hospice?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I think that's the best situation. I say that because I think that allows the patient to get the most benefit. With hospice care, so we know that they benefit from being on hospice for a longer time. We also know that people typically have a very short stay on hospice. So many people, especially in the adult world, end up beginning hospice care within a week of dying, which really doesn't give them a lot of time to reap the benefits, both physical and psychosocial. However, when palliative care is involved, often the palliative care team are the ones saying, hey, you know what, we should probably start thinking about hospice care. And so that allows people, if that's the right path for them, to get onto hospice care earlier. I think also having those relationships, like I was talking about before, is so valuable. So having even earlier palliative care so that we can form a relationship and help to know people, it makes such a difference to be able to say, hey, remember when we talked about XYZ a few months ago? And we said, if this happens, that, you know, this is sort of what we would want, or this is important. Remember that? I'm worried that we're at that place now. Or we can say, hey, I've seen you or your child. Remember 6 months ago when they were walking around really easily and playing, and now they don't have the energy to do that? It sort of allows you to align and share some objective observations that they know you had because you've known each other for this long. I just think it makes everything, it allows us to do an even better job. And I think it makes, understandably, people trust us more and really be able to collaborate thoughtfully.
And how do you determine who is actually eligible for hospice? And specifically in this section, if you could talk about the difference between pediatric and adult hospice care, that would be really helpful.
Absolutely. So in order to be eligible for hospice, this goes for anybody, no matter what age, you need to have a terminal illness that, by the judgment of two physicians, which we know that that's imperfect, but the way we phrase it is that if this illness continues to progress as expected, the expected prognosis is less than 6 months. Okay, which is hard, but there, you know, there's ways to prognosticate either by knowing the usual course of a disease or seeing how somebody's functional status has been declining. So you need to have a terminal illness with an expected prognosis of less than 6 months. I'm going to make one little interjection here and say you do not get kicked off of hospice after 6 months. This is a common misconception. And people think, oh, I don't want to sign on because then if you don't die, they kick you off. That's not true. You still have to be eligible. So if you turn around and get better, that's a wonderful thing. But it's not like you're only allowed to get it for 6 months. I've had many patients on for a year or two. So that's overall hospice. This is where it gets tricky or really nuanced between adults and pediatric patients. So in the adult world, in order to elect hospice care or have, it's a Medicare benefit, so have Medicare be paying for that care, you have to, unfortunately, forego a lot of the other treatments you may have been doing. So treatments aimed at fighting whatever disease, whatever's your main diagnosis that's causing you to have this poor prognosis, or that are aimed at just life prolongation. So your typical examples people think about are chemotherapy, dialysis, you know, surgical interventions, those things. You, unfortunately, you can't have both based on the way that this benefit has been structured. But that's for adults. When the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, there was a section allowing for what we call concurrent care. And that is for children or nationally up to age 21, patients who would like to continue some of those life-prolonging treatments can do that and can also have hospice support alongside it. Now, they still have to have a terminal diagnosis, so we still have to think that they are likely to pass away within 6 months, which gets especially tricky, as you might imagine, when we're also continuing treatments. But that's okay. That's a nuance that I think we're lucky to, you know, to have to navigate, that they can get that kind of support. So that's the difference. When I talk about concurrent care, I mean children who unfortunately likely are heading toward the end of life, but they don't have to sort of quote unquote, give up and stop everything else, which is amazing. Here in Rhode Island, we actually have legislation extending concurrent care up to age 26 years, which is amazing. And I'm so grateful for it. I don't know what the age limit is in other states. I know that nationally it goes up to 21, but states can have their own, you know, legislation or decision about how long to extend that.
Very cool. So speaking about like accessibility for hospice care, are there known healthcare disparities? What type of studies are there? Like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's tons. And they are what you also might unfortunately expect, knowing about the many other disparities that exist in healthcare. So most of the studies I'm aware of were looking at adult patients because they're just so much larger in number in terms of hospice patients. But in general, patients who are non-white and or Hispanic have much lower rates of hospice utilization. And unfortunately, that often translates to higher rates of intensive or, you know, hospitalized care at the end of life. Again, this gets a little bit at sort of quality of life and what's important. And for some people, knowing that they have had every intervention done, that really is important to them. So I don't want to assume that, you know, dying at home on hospice is absolutely the right decision for everybody. It's not. But we do use that as sort of a quality marker to make sure that we're doing a good job in healthcare, that we're hopefully recognizing when things are becoming futile, or, you know, we should at least be talking to people about maybe not being in the hospital anymore. And so, unfortunately, our historically and typically disadvantaged populations do seem to have a lower rate of whether access to or acceptance of that type of care. I don't know that I can parse out the difference, but there is a disparity, just like there is in so many other aspects, such as mortality or other things of healthcare in this country.
Yeah, and I've certainly seen some examples of that, and it can be really frustrating for families and providers, for sure.
Definitely.
We've talked a little bit about like cancer and end-stage heart failure. Are there other patient populations that we should think more about hospice in?
Yeah, I really think literally anyone, if someone is dying or they're coming toward the end of their life, hospice is for them. I think you point out a pretty common misconception that people think it's for cancer patients, but it's for anyone. Now, I think sometimes it's harder to prognosticate in non-oncologic diagnoses just because, you know, they maybe less often lead to the end of life, or it's just, I think though medicine is still catching up, right? So palliative care became a specialty in like the early 2000s, and the Medicare Hospice Act, I believe, was enacted in the early 80s. So it hasn't been for that long, if you look at like the scope of the history of medicine, that we have been putting any focus on like, hey, what if we didn't have to do all these things, or should we maybe not do things just because we're able to do them? You were asking about other diagnoses in which we should consider palliative care and hospice. Really, any of them. I think it's newer, quote unquote, to think about these things in, say, cardiac care and respiratory care. But even in my relatively short time of running my hospice team, I have had patients certainly with oncologic disorders. I've had patients with non-oncologic hematologic disorders, patients with heart failure, patients with chronic respiratory failure, patients with genetic abnormalities or metabolic abnormalities or neurologic diseases or the sequelae of a neurologic insult. Unfortunately, in kids, you know, often that first year of life and like the perinatal area, a lot of things can happen and can go wrong. So any of those things, if it is leading toward the end of life, it's absolutely appropriate to involve hospice and or palliative care.
One question I have is, you know, obviously this is a difficult situation for patients and their families, and I'm glad you already discussed exactly sort of how you start the conversations, but how do you navigate the situation where most of the providers, a lot of family members who aren't making the final decision, say a lot of the things we're doing is futile or may not be helping the patient or maybe even prolonging some suffering, and they have parents or guardians are just very attached to the idea that doing anything other than the management for the disease is sort of like giving up or something. And that's often the phrase that I hear. And I guess some of this concurrent care discussion also maybe helps that a little bit too.
Yeah, it definitely helps because we're not having to make an either or decision necessarily. I do think the family still has to make a decision to involve hospice care, and that's not a small thing to sign your child onto hospice. I recognize that's an incredible thing, an incredibly difficult thing to ask any family to do. You know, this all gets back to the importance of forming relationships over time too, to give us information, to give us kind of clout, right? Or like rapport that we can go there and have hard conversations with families, but also gives us insight into things we've observed, you know, like, hey, so-and-so was in the hospital, you really were talking about how difficult this is and how you mentioned thinking that, wow, how much time do they have and they're spending it here? You know, let's talk a little bit more about that. So it just gives us sort of more insight into the family. You know, this does get back to what I was saying, that my job is not to force or, you know, try to influence families to choose one way or the other. And something that I often have to take a step back and deal with for my own self is that this is not my decision and this does not need to mirror my values. And a family might have very different values than me. Really, my goal is to make sure that I'm helping them to understand what the options are and how those fit into what the medical reality. I think it's really hard if it's one thing if families just have a different set of, say, goals or values than I might. And if they're clear on that, then hey, that is fine. I'm always going to advocate for you. I think it's hard when you worry that there's maybe less understanding of the implications of decisions. And really, I always kind of come back to questions. And so one of my favorite questions to navigate some of these things are, you know, we know that here's where we are. I always summarize, you know, with so-and-so's care. What are you really hoping for right now? Because hope is such a loaded thing that people worry about going on hospice is giving up hope or whatnot. And I think there's always things we can hope for. And when families tell me they're hoping for a miracle, I will say, I join you in that. That would be amazing. But it can also be a jumping off point to think about, well, what would a miracle look like right now? Because if they know they need one, that does tell me they have an understanding of what's going on. Or what are you hoping for? And if they say, I just want them to be comfortable, well, great. That's a really important thing. And that really important piece of information, and that helps me explore further. Do you think they're comfortable right now? Or people will often say, I don't want them to suffer. We could talk about what would suffering look like? Like, let's really kind of like get in there and think about the nitty gritty of what's going on. And is this what you want for them or not?
And once a family has decided to enroll their child in hospice, how do you describe the services of hospice? Like, who is involved in hospice care, and what does it actually look like on the ground, especially for home hospice?
Yeah. So hospice is a team sport. Absolutely. So a hospice team consists of the physician, who often is not so front-facing with the families. I think it's nice because I often know families from the hospital and so already have some rapport with them. But really, if they're at home, their nurse and social worker and sort of the other members of the team are doing a lot of the care, always in conversation with me. But it's helpful to lay that out to also so they don't expect, like, Dr. Becky isn't coming to make a weekly visit. I wish I could with all my patients, but that's not what's going to happen. So I'm sort of at the helm overseeing, helping guide, you know, what are we doing for symptom management? I'm coordinating with other teams, especially when patients are still getting disease-directed care. The hospice nurse is an incredibly key player on the team. What I tell people is, so first of all, it's not block nursing care. So it's not a nurse who's going to be in the home for 8 hours a day, you know, managing the G-tube or whatnot. It is skilled nursing visits, so they're usually about an hour. As a side note, you can keep your block nursing if you're on concurrent care. That's one of the wonderful things for pediatrics with concurrent care. You don't have to give that up. But your hospice nurse usually visits, I tell people, about once a week on average to start with, just to give them a baseline. You know, that absolutely can and will accelerate as there are changes happening. And oftentimes at the end of life, if the patient's at home, the nurse might be out there every day. But, you know, about once a week to start out with, if the family's doing really well, the child's doing really well, and they don't want to visit 1 week, that's okay. Like, we have to see them with a certain frequency, but like, we can go a week or two if we need to. And honestly, that's great. That means they're doing well. Like, they're going to go do something. That's wonderful. We don't want to get in the way of that. So there's the nurse who is sort of reporting back to me and saying, hey, they're having more of this symptom. What do we think we could do about that? Sort of helping and supporting there. There's a lot of psychosocial support through hospice. So you get assigned a social worker and a chaplain. Their interaction with families can be as much or as little as the family desires, and that can change over time. So sometimes families are like, whoa, I'm not ready for that right now. And then as the person's, you know, course progresses, maybe they want it. But they always are introduced to the person in the beginning. So they know, like, here's a person you can call. We also have hospice aides, and they are, I would say, less often an active part of the care team in pediatrics because, frankly, kids are littler. So unless they're like adolescent or adult age, they're small. So there isn't as much physicality to the everyday caregiving. Certainly with adults, or I've had, you know, with teenager, young adult patients, it is helpful to have a hospice aide. They can often visit like 3 times a week. And we try to coordinate so that they can help with those more physical tasks, whether it's bathing, showering, turning. They're incredible. They often form really loving relationships with the kids and families too. But those are the times that we think of like, okay, this is going to be a really key, part of this person's care team. And then every patient on hospice, and this is one of the huge benefits of it, the family and close friends, we don't like look for a family diagram to make sure people are related. It's fine. Their loved ones have access to individualized bereavement support after the patient passes. And that extends for 13 months because anniversaries are so hard. So we need to at least help support them through the first anniversary. And that's a huge benefit I often talk about. Like, you know, people might be facing the worst. I think a child dying, I think, is the most unnatural and worst thing that many of us can ever imagine happening. And so saying like, we're here for the patient, but we're here for you too. A lot of times families have been doing everything to support the patient and they're not really getting any support or not even seeking or accepting support themselves. So to be able to have part of our team that really focuses on them is really important.
So you just sort of hit something that I want to ask you a little more about. So first you said that, you know, in terms of nursing or aides and so forth, you know, they're not there 24/7. So that means a large portion of the team is the family support structure. How do you talk to families about that? Because maybe some may not have realized that they will actually, at least with home hospice, that they're going to actually be a large portion of the team. Especially, how do you discuss it with, you know, family members who are like afraid of medicine, don't feel like they know anything about medicine, and now all of a sudden they're a primary caregiver? How do you do that discussion with them?
So it's another area that it's a little bit different with children, because very often the family has already been giving quite a bit of care. Unless this is a patient who's been in the hospital their whole life, the family is already doing a lot of care on their own. Still, they might be now needing to give certain medications that they weren't before. And we really express to them, like, we're here for you. We support you. Our nurses are amazing and will literally teach them how to administer meds. Most of what we use are oral or really concentrated like drops that can go under your tongue. And that goes for adult hospice too. And our nurses will like mark on the syringes how much to draw up, or when they go for a visit, they'll draw up a bunch of extra doses and have them labeled. Our nurses will fill medication boxes. We will really help with a lot of that. And so much is education and anticipatory guidance and support for the family. But you're right. I'm always very open with folks, and I say that both so that they don't expect this to be block nursing and because I want them to know they are going to be involved in this. It's, again, different in children because most times somehow there's an arrangement like kids aren't just alone all the time, like they have a caregiver. So while that nature changes, the fact of someone being present doesn't. But the other really excellent thing about hospice care is that you have 24/7 access to help and advice by phone. So any time of day or night, like, it's not like, oh, I can only get advice or guidance from my nurse when they're there like once a week, if that's the frequency. They have a number they can call anytime 24/7. There is triage available, which is nurses who can give guidance over the phone, saying, okay, well, this is your medication. You took one of those. Okay, it's okay to take another. And then we're going to talk to the doctor. So there's always a hospice doctor on call. And especially with pediatric patients, I always put together a pediatric action plan so that our triage and my covering colleagues will know, like, hey, here's what this kid is on, here's how I would titrate it, or here's the dose I would start at for this medication. So they can guide them over the phone. And if that isn't enough or they need more help, a hospice nurse can actually go out to the home even in the middle of the night. So it's not, they're not going to get there immediately, but still, I think just knowing there's this safety net of someone I can call or like help can be on the way is a huge, huge part of, I think, the value of offering the service.
How do you prepare families for kind of like the last days or hours of life and what they should do, what they should look out for, and how they can help their child pass peacefully?
Yeah. So this is a time that I often will set up another home visit for me to go out because I think it's really valuable. I just think it's such an important time. So like even when we have patients who did not come from the hospital where I work, I go out for the admission visit because I think if you're going to sign your kid on hospice, you deserve to see the face of the physician who's going to help care for them. And when we're getting toward end of life, if I haven't been making visits for other reasons, that's another reason I'll often come out, partnering with the nurse, so because we're just a team and we're going to like think about this and talk about this together. I think one of the awesome parts of pediatrics that I think all the rest of medicine should adopt is anticipatory guidance. And this is like, this came so naturally to me before I subspecialized because I'm a pediatrician, but I think it's a really key part of palliative care and hospice care too, of like, most people don't have a ton of experience with death. They don't know what to expect. They don't know what it's going to look like. And they don't know like when they should call or like what, just what to expect. And so educating patients and families is such a huge rewarding piece of my job. So I will go out and meet with them and kind of make sure we're all on the same page and say, based on this, that I'm seeing, I'm worried that their body is shutting down and they're going to die soon. And as another side note, it's really important to use the D word. We don't want to use euphemisms. We want to make sure that we're being clear about what we're talking about. Almost no matter what a patient is dying of, toward the end, we expect to see a couple of really common threads that just run through your body shutting down in the end of life. So people tend to be more tired. If they were up and active at all, which they probably haven't been if they're really getting toward the end, we just expect to see less and less of that. Even if they're in bed all the time, if they've been awake at all, I tell people we're going to see less and less of that. I expect them to have more time asleep and less time awake. I can't predict sort of how long they'll be awake for or when will be the last time that they're awake. So I tell people to expect them to have less time of being awake or lucid, and anything we get beyond what's expected is, a gift. Same thing with confusion. People can have a little bit of delirium at the end of life. People often say, oh, it's because of the medications. Actually, it is almost always because that's a part of the dying process. Your brain isn't always getting as much blood and oxygen. And it, depending on the underlying disease, for example, if you have cancer with metastases to the brain, like that can lead to more confusion or agitation. And so I tell them to expect more of that and having fewer periods of being sort of awake and not delirious or, being lucid. And again, it's not going to progress in a totally linear way. Like today they were awake for 4 hours and tomorrow they're awake for 3 hours. It's not like that. But it's, if you take a look at like the overall trajectory, you see a decrease and sort of expect that to continue. People also eat and drink less. And this is a huge challenge sometimes to help people understand, because they'll be like, well, they need to drink or they need to eat. In fact, their body is dying. And when the body is shutting down, it needs less calories and less fluids. One of my mentors who taught me always says, they're not dying because they're not eating and drinking. They're not eating and drinking because they're dying. And I find that's a really helpful statement to make to families, because right, like food is how we take care of each other. It's how we show love. And so sometimes like culturally and just from a place of like our normal customs, it's really hard not to like feed the person who's sick or try to support them in that way. But, because their body's needing less. If you give them too much food or fluid toward the end of life, they can't handle it. It can cause other problems. It can cause them to aspirate. It can cause them to have some fluid buildup. So that's a really key piece of that anticipatory guidance that I like to give. And then, you know, if they're having pain, that may increase as we're getting toward the end. And that's, I say that out loud so it's maybe a little bit less scary. And again, so we have a medication plan. Like, here's what we've been using. If we've only been using, say, PRN analgesia, we might end up needing to schedule it around the clock to make sure that we're keeping them comfortable. Or, hey, we've been doing that. We may need to adjust the dose, sort of talking through more specifics like that, I think and I hope makes it even a tiny bit less scary and more manageable when it's like, okay, I've heard this before. This is not completely new to me.
Make this your best season yet with nutritious 2-minute meals from Factor. Eating well has never been this easy. Just heat up and enjoy and giving you more time to do what you want. Factor meals arrive fresh and ready to eat, perfect for any active lifestyle, whether it be working in the hospital, taking care of a family, or spending time outdoors. With 45 weekly menu options, you can pick gourmet meals that fit your goals. Choose from Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and more. The variety means there is something for everyone. I love the chicken and even the pork, but sometimes I need to change things up with cacio e pepe. And if you need something else, Factor also offers breakfasts, on-the-go lunches, snacks, desserts, and even juices. Factor meals pack in the flavor with none of the fuss. So, Cribsiders listeners, get started at factormeals.com/Cribsiders50off and use code Cribsiders50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. That's code Cribsiders50off at factormeals.com/Cribsiders50off for 50% off plus free shipping.
So we've talked a lot about how to explain death and dying to family members and caretakers. You know, children aren't bystanders in this. The question is, and they may have varying understanding based on age, how do you approach discussing death and dying with children, and how do you change it based on their age and understanding?
It's another area where I rely heavily on questioning. And I also rely very much on my wonderful colleagues, social workers, who are often, you know, navigating this either alongside me or separately, as well as I'm going to put in a separate plug for a child life specialist. We're lucky enough to have them on our hospice team now, which is incredible, you know, just for support, but also for help with these types of discussions and understanding. So there are other key players in these conversations. I usually, whether I'm talking to the child who themselves is dying, or say like a sibling or cousin or whoever else is important in their life, I ask a lot of questions like, hey, I've noticed, you know, so-and-so has been awake less. Like, how has that been for you? Because that's just a good way to kind of open the door for like, hey, we can talk about this and I want to hear your thoughts, right? So usually I go with questions of like, oh, why do you think that's happening? Or, you know, and an important thing with kids is that they will shut down the conversation when they don't want to go farther. And that's almost across like developmental stages. So it's really important. And sometimes it takes people by surprise. They'll like maybe even talk about somebody dying and they'll be like, can we color now? And the answer is yes. Yes, you can color now. Because they take in the amount of information that they're kind of ready to process then, and then they need to stop, and that's okay. I think the most important thing is that they know that they can go back and ask more questions at any point. So sometimes if kids really aren't saying a lot, I'll say, hey, you know, I try to normalize everything, which I think is another very pediatric thing to do of like, hey, lots of my teenagers who have X, Y, and Z tell me this. So it's like, I'm not targeting you. I'm not accusing you or assuming things. And I'll say, you know, a lot of times when kids have a serious illness like this or whatever illness the kid has, like they feel some changes going on in their bodies. Have you ever felt anything like that? You know, or a lot of times when kids are facing X, Y, and Z, they have a lot of questions. I'm wondering what questions are on your mind. I've had kids who on their own realize they're dying, and I've had kids who do not want to talk about it. And then it's like this fine line of, I want, again, my values are that I think you should have the space to talk about it. But also, if you are truly like not, you may have come from a family where you don't talk about things a lot. And that can be hard because, you know, implicitly over their life, they've learned like, we don't talk about things that make people sad. And so you're not going to change a family's communication style when they're going through the worst thing in their life. But really like open-ended, open door, what are you thinking about this? Or what do you, you know, because kids are so perceptive. And I think especially if it's the child who's dying, I can only imagine they have to feel their body changing. And so I think really just acknowledging that and giving space to explore that as much as they're able to and wanting to, that's really the key to all of this.
I think meeting, you know, kids where they're at is so important, even just in the rest of pediatrics. So I can only imagine, you know, when you're talking with them about death and dying. And going back to like the logistics of hospice, we've talked a lot about home hospice, which is great because I feel like as inpatient providers, we often don't get to see what it looks like once they leave the hospital. But other than home hospice, are there inpatient units? Can they come back to the hospital if things are getting out of hand? Like, how do you decide where a patient should be for their hospice care?
Yeah, so the majority of hospice patients are at home. And frankly, that's sometimes the other way to work hospice into the conversation of like, I hear you saying you want to be at home, but you have a lot of needs. Can I tell you about a service that can help support that? And that's called routine hospice care. So what I described before with, you know, sort of a physician in the background, a nurse making visits, you know, social work, chaplaincy, sort of closely involved aides. But there is a higher level of hospice called inpatient hospice or general inpatient hospice. And that is for patients who, you know, meet the same criteria. So they have a terminal prognosis, we're expected to be 6 months or less, but they are having typically a symptom burden that is so great that it really can't be met at home or in another setting. When I say home, I also mean like for adults, sometimes that's like a nursing home or something like that. So the answer is yes, there are both inpatient hospice facilities and hospice can be done in a hospital. So I'll talk about the inpatient hospice facilities first. They're not super common. We have one here in my state, and it's the only one. So what we have is a 30-bed unit, and I tell people it's kind of like a hospital in that, you know, there's nurses and aides 24/7. There's physicians rounding every day. But the difference is everything we're doing is aimed at comfort. We're not doing disease-directed things. So it's usually people end up coming there if their symptoms really can't be managed at home. And I would say most commonly that's pain, but it could be agitation. It could be, you know, incredible nausea. So because we can do things more easily, we can do things either IV or even subcutaneously. If you use a subcutaneous needle, it is far more comfortable than an IV, and you can still administer things the same way, like at the same concentrations and dosing as you would IV. So that's an option, and that can be great, especially if the family, you know, if their symptom burden is so high and the family's like, we can't do this, and the family really wants to just be the family. And I don't mean just like that's not an important role, but that they don't want to have to be or aren't capable of doing the medication administration and sort of deciding when they need a PRN and things like that. You can also deliver that level of care in a hospital, although I am pretty sure the specifics of that are really going to vary by location. So where I practice, our hospice team has partnerships with many of the hospitals. And so patients can physically stay in the hospital, but receive that level of care. So they're still cared for by the hospital staff, but a hospice nurse is making daily visits and speaking with a hospice physician to get recommendations that are then relayed to the hospital medical team. That is So like I said, that might not be available everywhere. And really for us here, it's when we can't get them over to our inpatient hospice unit because either it's full or they're so unstable that we don't even think they would survive like an ambulance ride across town. So we use it. We use it in children also, but it's sort of this really elevated level of hospice for people who just need such intensive interventions that it really needs to be in that more like medical facility setting.
So this is a little, I don't really have a good transition for this part, but my next question would be sort of similar to what we sort of had discussed about concurrent care is, Do patients need to be DNR or DNI to enroll in hospice care? I know this is something that, you know, at least with some of my adult patients, is a common discussion as we sort of talk about, you know, at least with adults, you can only do one or the other. So that means what we're doing is not, you know, it wouldn't be useful. And so we should be DNR, DNI. Like, is that the same discussion we have in our pediatrics? And if so, how do you make that discussion? I assume it's pretty similar to all the death and dying discussions we've already had.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. That is another incredibly common misconception about hospice, and not just for pediatric patients. No, there is not a rule that you have to be DNR, DNI, or comfort measures only to sign on to hospice. I would say, especially in my pediatric patients, they often come onto service full code, because we may not have quite gotten there yet, or especially with concurrent care, we are doing a lot of things, you know, aimed at their disease that really are life prolonging. But no, it's not like, all right, you got to stop everything on hospice. We're not doing this. No, in most of those cases, we do work toward those discussions. Again, after we have rapport built and a relationship to really think about what do we want for this patient? What do we, by we, I mean the family, what are our shared goals here? But it's not a barrier. I would say it's another case where having a trusting relationship built over time makes it that much smoother to have these discussions and to help guide them, because it's like someone that you know knows your kid and knows you care about them. I've also had, in the past few months, I actually had one discussion with a family whose child was getting concurrent care and they were back in the hospital for something and code status came up. And I said, you know what? At this point in this person's illness, I do think there actually are some things that might be reversible. And so if that's, you know, within your goals, like let's say they get a bad pneumonia that we think is treatable, like intubation might be a thing that's consistent with what you want. Like, I'm never going to tell you, no, you can't do that. And I can't even in that case say, no, I don't think they'd get off the ventilator. But it was also a really nice opportunity to plant the seed and do some anticipatory guidance that, like, there is going to come a point where we talk about this again and where I tell you that doing those things, mainly CPR, intubation, will not work and will only cause them pain and suffering at the end of life. And I'm going to urge you or encourage you to say, what I always say to people is to draw a line in the sand. Because also being DNR, DNI doesn't mean you're on hospice and it doesn't mean that we're not doing anything else. It only means that in the most acutely critical scenario that there's something that we're not going to do the things that likely aren't going to help. I say, so it's this line in the sand. And so that when their heart and lungs stop, we allow them to stop and allow them to pass peacefully and treat any symptoms. We're not going to, I describe CPR like in all of its gory detail because I think many lay people don't know. You know, I'd say we're not going to pound on their chest and crack their ribs. We're not going to put a tube in their throat and put them on machines. We're going to be by their side and allow them to pass peacefully. So again, it's a very fraught discussion, but it is not one that has to be had or a decision. It's not like a prerequisite for coming onto hospice. And the same is true for adult patients. I would say it's less common. Often adult patients, you know, because they don't have access to concurrent care for the most part, and they are kind of shifting their priorities, a lot of times that goes along with changing a code status, but it's not like, okay, you're saying all the right things and this is what you want, but if you can't get yourself to make that decision or sign that paper right now, you don't get the support. That is not the case at all.
We have covered a lot of ground in this episode, and I think we've learned a lot more about hospice. What are your main take-home points that you want our listeners to walk away with?
Oh, my goodness. How many can I have? No, I'm kidding.
as many as you want.
So I think, especially for pediatrics, being aware of concurrent care and the fact that children up to 21 nationally and potentially later in certain states can have access, can continue some of their disease-directed treatments and also get the benefit of hospice support. I think a huge one, especially, you know, as providers listen to this, is just early. There's rarely a time when we're going to say, you know, I think that's too early for palliative care. maybe hospice, maybe we might not quite be at a 6-month prognosis, but I always kind of laugh to myself when people say, I know you like early consults, so we're consulting you now. And usually I'm like, no, this was the right time. It wasn't super duper early. This was a good call. So really kind of allowing us to sort of join the care team and start to participate and just start to support families and build a relationship so that we can move toward these more difficult things as they come. That's really certainly a gift to us as the team. And I like to think it's a gift to families. I think those are the two biggest things. And then just hospice myths. You don't have to die within 6 months. You don't have to be DNR, DNI. And if you're not sure, ask your friendly palliative care consultant. You know, I think it's better to ask because more often than not, I think people would probably be surprised that they are appropriate cases or cases where we can really kind of lend some help and support.
Fantastic. Thank you again for spending tonight to educate us, educate our listeners. I know I learned a lot, so I'm sure everyone else will. Before we sign off, I want to give you a chance. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Any websites or societies or anything at all?
Well.
Oop, too big of a question. I'm sorry.
No, I think as with all of medicine, you know, going toward reputable sources is always the way to go. You know, for hospice and palliative medicine, it's the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. Just for those facts and things, that's really important. There is also a now pretty robust and ever-growing body of literature on hospice and palliative medicine topics. So that's it's out there. It's not sort of a just hand wavy thing. There's a science to it. And then there's an awesome, awesome website that I believe is also an app that I always direct learners to, and it's called Fast Facts. It's through the Medical College of Wisconsin, I believe, and it is phenomenal. It's a resource of evidence-based, like one-page quick summaries on, I think they have over 400 topics now related to like hospice and palliative care and symptom management. I still use it myself because I'm always like, okay, is there some third line thing that I haven't thought of, you know, for this symptom? Or if I need the literature supporting what I kind of already know or what I think I'm going to do, it's great because it'll be like a quick outline, bullet point recommendations, and then always supported by citations from the literature. So it's phenomenal. I recommend it to everybody. You don't have to be doing a palliative care, you know, fellowship or consult. It can be really helpful, especially for symptom management for anybody practicing any other part of medicine.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm definitely going to check those out. I appreciate you spending the time with us. Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback, so subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or any place you get your podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer this episode, Dr. Clara Mao, as well as our showrunner, Dr. Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I have been Chris the Chi Manchu.
I've been Clara Mao. Thank you, and good night.
And for those who made it all the way to the end, you're going to be graced with a new bonus. Well, I guess another bonus. A poem written by AI. In this realm where twilight softly falls, a sanctuary of peace gently calls. Pediatric hospice, a haven of grace, where care enfolds in a tender embrace. Dear parents, come close with hearts open wide in this space where serenity and love reside. Your child, a precious soul on a delicate flight, finds comfort and dignity in the fading light. Here, every moment is cherished with care, and laughter and memories we lovingly share. Music and stories fill the air, a celebration of life beyond compare. Pain and discomfort we gently ease, with expertise that brings a soothing breeze. Families together, in support we weave, a tapestry of strength as we believe. Fear not, dear parents, in this gentle place, for compassion and kindness brightly interlace. Together, in this journey of whispered sighs, we honor each breath, each smile, each goodbye. In this garden of tranquility, where love is the guide, we walk beside you with steps quiet and wide. Pediatric hospice, where endings blend with new starts, cradling your child and your family's hearts. See you guys. Bye.